Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Welcome to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. Listener discretion is advised.
He laid it on the counter. He said, "Lenny, how you like that scoundrel?" That baby there, I said, "It's a rifle like the rest of the rifle." He said, "No," he said, "this is a special one." Said, "That baby's special."
How did that rifle look?
It looked like a regular hunting gun with the sight, with the thing.
A long-barreled hunting rifle?
You know
rifle,
what I said? It looked like one of those Browning guns. That's what I always would say, because I guess Remington Browning is about the only thing I would know. But I didn't touch it, and I don't know why I didn't, because it was on the counter there. It land right in front of me.
Did it look like it was a new gun? Was it new?
It was brand new.
Brand new, yeah. Like it was a brand new gun.
Yes, it looked like it hadn't never been, hadn't been abused at all.
It hadn't been fired, it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Did it have a scope on it, I think?
Yes, sir. Had a scope on top.
It did have a scope.
What color was the stock?
It was brown. It was nice work. I guess you might call it woodwork. It was a good look.
Made a lot of noise.
Yeah, it did make a lot of noise. It didn't look like the type of gun to do that.
Right.
It was a strange looking rifle, but it made a tremendous noise every time he would shoot it down in that gun range.
How long would he stay down the gun range practicing?
Oh, this is his first time. I saw him that day and that day only that he shot that rifle. And he shot it all day. He spent time with it all that day. I called the Union Hall. I said, "It's a matter of life and death." I said, "I think these people are planning to kill Dr. King."
The authorities would parade, "Oh, we found a gun that James Earl Ray bought in Birmingham that killed Dr. King." Except, it wasn't the gun that killed Dr. King.
James Earl Ray was a pawn for the official story.
From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV.
The plan was to get King to the city because they wanted it handled in Memphis where Daddy and them could handle it.
I'm Bill Klaber, and this is the MLK Tapes. Lenny Curtis was a black custodian at the Memphis Police firing range in April of 1968. He witnessed several disturbing things the day King was shot and in the days leading up to it. Afraid for his family, he kept those events to himself for over 30 years. But Curtis did tell a friend of his, who contacted Bill Pepper. Pepper convinced the friend to at least let him speak to Curtis.
Lenny told me the story, and then I convinced Lenny to go under oath in a deposition and be filmed and tell the story, but in front of Martin King III. And he did all of that. The deal was that I would not reveal what he said whilst he was alive.
The Curtis deposition was recorded in April of 2003, but the tape itself remained in the custody of Bill Pepper as per his agreement with Lenny Curtis. Also in attendance was Martin King III and attorney Lewis Garrison, who had asked many of the questions, as we'll hear now.
Back in 1968, Ms. Curtis, you were employed by the Memphis Police Department, am I correct, sir? And at that time, you were working at the firing range?
Yes, sir, as a custodian.
Okay. Before April 4th of 1968, you knew I have an officer there whose name was Earl Clark. Am I correct, sir?
Captain Clark, yes, sir.
And also there was an officer named Frank Strouser. Is that right, sir?
He was a patrolman, yes, sir.
Patrolman, right, sir. Now, Ms. Curtis, just tell us before April 4th some things you had heard from both of those sources about Dr. King's presence here in Memphis.
Oh, I heard Mr. Strouser say that somebody was going to blow his, blow his motherfucking brains out.
Okay.
We had set two TVs in which we call a lounge, in a lounge area, and that they had a reserve police officer, which was rookie policemen. You know, they didn't, you could tell. So they was in uniform waiting on a standby, and they was looking at the TV. And Mr. Strouser came in and stood up, stopped in the lounge while the TV was on, and he made the statement that he'd get his fucking brain blowed out. Okay. And he went on down into the area where the gun room down in the basement. And that's what first gave me I started thinking, because we was in an area where he couldn't see us, and we was in the kitchen, in the cook area of the lounge. And he couldn't see us, so I told James not to say anything, so we just stood. And we talked about it, and I told James, I said, son, I don't feel good about that, because he was shooting that gun all that day.
When Curtis refers to the gun that Frank Strouser was shooting at the range as that gun, he was talking about a particular rifle, the Special Baby, with a polished wood stock that had been shown to him just a few days before by a close friend of Strouser's, a fireman named Roy Young. And when Curtis was asked to describe what he saw or heard on the day King was killed, it went right back to Frank Strouser and that gun.
He was shooting the gun all day, but when he came up, it was during the time that we was getting ready to leave, and we was in the same location we were during the lunch hour.
I mean, about what time of the day was this roughly, would you say?
That was about 3 o'clock.
Okay.
So we was cleaning up, and here he come up out of the thing with the rifle.
That same rifle when they said it was special
looked
gun?
Looked like the same rifle to me.
What did he do?
He went to Mr. Young's car. He had a Volkswagen, Mr. Strouser did, but he left in Mr. Young's car that day. Ruffled his hair up, and then he turned into what I say a fireman, because he had a white t-shirt on, blue pants, and put a pair of dark sunglasses on. But he let the top back.
All right, and then you saw him leave?
Yes, sir. He got in the car and pulled off.
Okay.
When he left, I waited until he got out of the drive, and I went across the street to the Board of Education. I had only two phone calls fare. I called the Union Hall, talked to the lady there. It was a reception there. The young lady I spoke to, I said, this is something very important. And she said, what is it, sir? I said, it's a matter of life and death. And she said, whose life and what, I said, I think these people are planning to kill Dr. King. And I said, I want to talk to Reverend Smith. She said, well, he probably with Dr. King. I said, no way, ma'am, you could get in touch with him. She says, not at this time, sir. So I called Dr. Vasco Smith. I let his phone ring for I don't know how long. No one ever answered. I don't guess nobody was there. So I had no more money. I went back to the police department across the street, and I sat over there for a while. Then I left and went on home. And when I got home, my wife and I was in the kitchen, and it came over the radio, and it just knocked me down. And I have lived with it so long, the fact that I said, well, now, am I the only somebody that could have helped? And I did all I could, and I could. I think about moving, or am I safe here? And you know, I've been through a thing with this thing with me and my children, and they scared for me. You know, they scared for me, but the Lord told me to not to worry. I wanted to tell this here. I've been wanting to tell it all my life.
But Curtis's worries didn't stop when King was killed. They increased because Frank Strouser seemed to think that Lenny Curtis had seen too much and had put the pieces together, that he knew what Strouser had done.
He was aware that Lenny saw everything that was going on, knew everything that was going on. So he definitely intimidated Lenny for quite a period of time.
Curtis tried to stay out of the way whenever Frank Strouser came around, but he could feel Strausser looking at him. Some months after the King killing, after he hadn't said a word to Curtis since the murder, Strausser approached Curtis and asked him to come with him on an errand. Curtis felt an immediate fear.
You said, I believe he contacted you one day and asked you about riding down to pick up the payroll.
That was surprising to me because
he had never done that before.
Said nothing to me.
Yeah. He had never even spoken to you before other than just remarks
right.
You heard.
Okay. And my mind told me to go.
Okay. What did he say? Do you remember?
He said, Lenny said, you got your work caught up? And I just said, yeah. He said, you want to ride down with me, pick up the check? And I went, and I knew what he was going to ask me, but I didn't know where he was going to ask me. We went and got in the car.
Was he armed at the time?
He had his gun on. I was looking at it.
Did he put his hand on his gun?
He didn't put his hand on it. Okay. He didn't touch it because I was watching it.
Yeah, but just two of you in the car?
Two of us in the car. Right. I think he said he was married, asked me was I married. Then when we got down by the poplar in the North Parkway, he turned and went through the wood area where the zoo at.
Right.
You know, and I'm wondering, because we on poplar, all we got to do is go straight down to the deer hide. When we got around them curves where it get deep, the grass, he said, Lenny, what do you think about that guy Ray killing King? Just like that.
Yeah.
I said, all he did, I said, there's no doubt about it. You know, I had to say that. I said, there's no doubt about it. I said, I know he did it. Everybody know he did it. Talking about Mr. Ray. And then he asked me, he said, are you still doing private detective work? You know, I was in security, doing security guard stuff. I said, yeah. He said, you still working with those FBIs? And periodically, I had some couple of FBIs that would bring me wanted posters. I said, yeah. I said, periodically, we work together. And he told me, he said, Lenny, you be careful, yeah.
But Frank Strausser always seemed to feel that Lenny Curtis was a danger to him. And time and again, Strausser would stalk Curtis, either to frighten him or possibly worse.
Strange thing was happening to me. At one time on whatever box cell, somebody turned my gas off and turned it back on. But it was in the wintertime and I got cold and woke up and smelled the gas. And so that next week, I noticed a car sitting across the street. It was a Lincoln. And I looked in there, I said, now that's a car that don't supposed to be there. Before I come out, I always do that in the morning because, like I said, I was scared. That one time I was really scared. So I noticed the car, observed the car, and I looked at it real careful, kept looking, and I saw a head move. And I said, So by that time, I went back in the house, got my pistol, and I loaded it, put it in my pocket. And like I normally do, I would go out and start my car and let it run. This time, something the Lord told me. He told me, he said, when you get ready to go, go. Don't warm your motor up or nothing. So I got in my car and turned the ignition and took off without even turning my lights on. And just as I went to pull out, he pulled out, and it was him.
Officer Strausser?
And at that particular time, it was during Christmas time, they were saying something about they had new evidence. And every time they come up with new evidence, he would pop up some kind of way or something.
In recounting the day King was killed, Curtis gave an interesting description of the way Strausser looked as he left the firing range. Curtis said, quote, he turned into what I said was a fireman, referring to Strausser in the informal dress of a fireman, complete with white t-shirt, ruffled hair, and sunglasses. He also left in a fireman's car. I asked Bill Pepper about this.
He was driving Roy Young's car. Roy Young's had privileges at the fire station number 2, so he was able to park the car there. And he did change his physical appearance. Yes, he did that.
And since the fire station erupted like a beehive as soon as King was shot, being dressed like a fireman wouldn't be a bad way to blend in and then disappear, if that's what happened. Once Bill Pepper heard Lenny Curtis's testimony, he naturally began to look at Frank Strausser, though he had to be cautious because sudden interest would put Curtis in danger, something Pepper had promised not to do. Pepper found out that Strausser was new to the Memphis police force at the time of the King killing, having recently returned from Vietnam, where he'd been wounded and lost a brother. Pepper also found a cop who had briefly served as Strausser's partner in a squad car. He told Pepper that Strausser was out of control, acting as though he was untouchable, with numerous abuses of power, like when he went into a black bar screaming N-word this and N-word that, and emptied his pistol into the jukebox. Pepper also ran across a reference to Strausser in It Came from Memphis, a book by Robert Gordon about the music scene in the 60s. Gordon described Strausser as a brawler recently back from Nam. Quoting here, "He got wired on his own adrenaline in the Vietnam jungle, and the chill rush of danger in his lower backbone had become as necessary to him as air going in and out of his lungs. Upon returning to Memphis, he'd become a cop, the paramilitary uniform and the weapon sort of a methadone." The book would go on to describe how Strausser would muscle in on the pimps and dope dealers working Beale Street, and how, after hours, he would team up with a friend and go to bars looking for people to beat up. For most people, such a character reference might be enough to just stay clear of the man. But when Lenny Curtis died in 2013, Bill Pepper decided to find Strausser and talk to him.
I didn't necessarily expect that I would get anything out of it, but I thought I'd be remiss if I didn't try to have some conversation with this guy. I saw him where he was living. I just went out there one day. He was doing his laundry, and they came out to see me, and I introduced myself to him, and I said, "I'd like to talk to you at some point. You were an officer at the time of the killing, and I'd like to know what you believe happened and so forth." Then I invited him to have lunch with me, and I offered him $500 if he would sit down in a restaurant and have lunch with me, which he did.
So Bill Pepper decided to have lunch with the man he believed killed Martin Luther King. Strausser, in his 70s, was driving a cab to support himself, and $500 seemed like good pay for an hour's work. So he said yes, and a date was set for the dining room of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis. Pepper then called his court reporter, Brian Dominski.
Bill asked that I have him wired for sound, and we did a rudimentary attempt at that, recorder in his pocket.
Besides the recorder, it was also thought a good idea if Pepper had additional people in the room. So Dominski and an associate were already at a nearby table when Strausser and Pepper sat down at the Peabody.
Unbeknownst to Strausser, we were sitting one table away, but Bill welcomed him, and they sat down, and they had about a 45-minute chat about what life was like in 1968 in Memphis.
But the small device that Bill had in his pocket wasn't up to the task, given the normal noise of a dining room. What it recorded was barely decipherable. Dominski, however, was able to produce a transcript, parts of which voice actors will perform for us right after the break.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
How are you, Frank?
How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah. Well, I did something to my back, so I'm not really all right.
Bill Pepper rises awkwardly from his chair to greet Frank Strausser, who notices his pain. Pepper says that he did something to his back, referring to something that was done to his back decades earlier. Pepper then hands Strausser an envelope with $500. Strausser nods, puts it in his pocket, and takes his seat. Once settled, it is Strausser who asks the first question.
So, what's on your agenda? You writing a book?
Yeah, I've written two on this case. This is going to be the final one, so I'm trying to cover all the bases. I'm going to go through a lot of stuff with you and take some notes, if I may, and I wanted to first ask your recollection of what things were like around the time this went on, this killing.
Sure.
Let's start with what you recall in the police department and what the atmosphere was like around the time of the assassination.
Okay. The department at that time was an old-school police department. It was before we started hiring for quotas and everything. So, most of the officers were a dying breed. They were dinosaurs.
Basically an all-white force.
Very few blacks, so it was a very tight-knit group of men.
Now, Holloman came in. When was that? What was your impression of him?
Holloman came in somewhere around January of 68. I didn't have that much to do with him. Those FBI guys pretty much stay with their own. He wasn't a street cop.
Yeah, he was with Hoover for a number of years. What was the attitude toward Martin King? I mean, amongst the police.
I don't think they had any liking for him. The sanitation workers went on strike, and then we monitored them, rode with them when they marched. The police officers were just doing their job.
So what was the atmosphere in the city, outside the police force, in terms of, was it explosive? Was it ready to...
No, not really. What did that? What changed the whole thing was 68.
You mean the assassination?
Well, the assassination, the sanitation workers going out. Prior to that, there weren't demonstrations. And then after the assassination, the blacks and everybody come downtown. Thieves, pickpockets, they ruined it. The rioters, whoever you want. Before then, everyone came to town to shop. And after, nobody came. So I think prior to that, the relationship was much better. Since then, Memphis has evolved into a racially charged city.
Frank Strausser starts his history of Memphis by referring to the police at the time of the King killing as dinosaurs, as if he has somehow moved on. But then he candidly puts himself back among them as he reveals his belief that it was the blacks who ruined the city. Things were much better before the sanitation workers got all stirred up about a union. Of course, the city might have saved itself a lot of trouble had they just paid their garbage men a living wage. But Pepper doesn't argue because he is pleased with the conversation. He had been half expecting Strausser to take the money and then become hostile or uncooperative. Pepper wants to keep the words coming, so he steers the conversation to something they had in common.
From what I know about you, you've had an interesting career because you were in the military, correct? In Vietnam.
I was in Vietnam, and I got hit pretty good.
Well, what year?
1966.
Huh. That's when I was there.
Oh, really? Were you military?
No. I was a journalist. Went there in the spring of 66 and took myself out to the Central Highlands. I was in a C-130, and we were landing in Pleiku, and they hit us going in. The plane made a very bad rough landing, and it started my back problems then. But those things happen. Those things happen. But you must have seen rough action.
I was in a couple of good ones. I ended up in the hospital in Osaka. Needed skin grafts. My brother wasn't so lucky. He died there.
I'm sorry to hear that. Younger brother?
2 years younger.
I understand that you were given some serious award.
The Army Commendation Medal for Valor.
But they gave it to you at the police roll call. Isn't that unusual?
It was good PR.
The conversation so far had gone better than Bill Pepper could have expected. Frank Strausser was calm and willing to talk about what things were like in Memphis back in the day. But that's all he had signed on to do. He hadn't agreed to talk about the murder of Dr. King. And Pepper didn't expect to get Strausser to fess up to anything or rat out anybody. But he also didn't want to squander the opportunity to poke around.
Do you remember where you were when King was shot?
Yeah, I was at home. I was at home. I had been at home. I forget what time he got killed.
He got killed about 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
Because I think I was working 7 to 7. I know I was working 7 to 7. So I was on my way to work. Because I heard it on the radio that he had been assassinated, and I was on my way to the precinct down at headquarters to go to work.
You remember hearing it on the radio? Driving to work?
Yes, driving to work.
Then all hell broke loose, I guess. What happened?
The riots broke out downtown. There was so much going on that I went on 12-hour shifts probably for the next 6 weeks.
Pepper, of course, is quite certain that Frank Strausser was not at home or in his car when King was killed. But Strausser is disarmingly relaxed about it all. So Pepper decides to lay a few more cards on the table.
Do you know what I've done or who I am?
I have no idea.
I was James Earl Ray's lawyer from 1988 until he died.
Oh. Okay.
I only took him on in 1988 after I'd spent 10 years convincing myself that he wasn't guilty of the crime. I tried desperately to get him a trial. I failed. They had him locked up all the way. I only knew Martin Luther King the last year of his life. After he was killed, I just walked away from it all. Politics and everything. Then, in 77, Abernathy called and asked me to question Ray in prison. I said, "What are you talking about? They got the right guy." But 6 months later, I spent 5 hours with James Earl Ray, and it was clear to me that he wasn't the shooter. The family asked me to look into it further. They want to know what happened, to have closure.
Strausser at first isn't sure how to respond to this. He stumbles just a touch and ends up by denying that he had ever anything to do with James Earl Ray, though Pepper had never suggested it.
You know if you have children, you know you want to find out who did it. I had no dealings with James Earl Ray. Never saw him.
I know.
So Pepper tells Strausser that he knows he didn't know James Earl Ray. It was an easy call because no one in Memphis knew James Earl Ray. Strausser then follows with a remarkable opinion as to why the case against Ray doesn't make much sense.
I'll just say this much, and I have a profound belief in this. I don't think James Earl Ray could have put all this together.
You're right about that.
Now, where it goes from there, Bill, I don't know. I could be totally incorrect, but with the kind of criminal background he had, this guy was, you know, he was a petty criminal.
That's right.
How can a guy like this, I don't think I ever had this thought before, why would he want to kill Martin Luther King?
Yes, there's no motive.
He is a black leader and you're a James Earl Ray over here. What's the reason for killing him?
Exactly.
I mean, to drift into Memphis and to suddenly have access to a room across the street and a rifle, and then to drop the rifle in a bag or a mattress or wrapped up in something? Give me a break. He didn't do it. There must have been other people involved.
One of the things I enjoy while trying to unravel this mystery is that people who are likely neck-deep in the murder don't seek refuge in the official story of how the King killing went down. You heard similar stuff from Lloyd Jowers when he spoke to Andrew Young and Dexter King. Oh, Ray couldn't have done all this, not in a million years. The official story is so weak, the framing of Ray so obvious, that even the beneficiaries of this story run away from it. So Strausser thinks there were other people involved. But who? Pepper has an idea or two.
The thing is, as hard as I've looked, I never found any indication that the CIA or the agency was involved in the killing of Martin King. I have found strong indications that the FBI was involved and that Hoover was involved.
Hoover hated King.
Hated him. He used Clyde Tolson, his number two, to come in here, bring money and set it up through the Dixie Mafia.
So even a lowly patrolman understood at the time that J. Edgar Hoover hated Martin Luther King. Not a great character reference for the man who was ultimately put in charge of the murder investigation. But Pepper's mention of the Dixie Mafia brings forth an unexpected confession from Strausser.
Years ago, there was this article in the Press Scimitar about people who had some connection to the Dixie Mafia, and my name was in there.
You could have sued them. You could have...
No. To be quite candid, I guess they got it right. Because I had not been involved directly, but I had known some pretty questionable characters. You know, from the Dixie Mafia to the actual Mafia. And it was well known that I was in a lot of activity with people who were involved in that sort of livelihood.
Frank Strausser has just admitted that over the years, he had engaged in a lot of activity with some pretty questionable characters. And Pepper thinks this might be the time to stir the pot. He tells Strouser that after the murder, the Memphis police made a plaster cast of a fresh footprint in the yard behind Jauer's place. This is true, a size 13 footprint, and that's significant because not that many men have a size 13 hoof. So Pepper then asked Strouser the size of his shoe, and years later, he told me what he saw on Strouser's face.
And he said 13 and a half with a little grin on his face. So he was telling me something, wasn't he?
Pepper may have gotten a grin from Strouser, but if he thought he'd get more of a reaction, he was wrong. So Pepper decided to try something else. He told Strouser that as Jauer's near death, he had named him as the shooter. This was not true. Jauer's had done no such thing. He had named Captain Clark, and by extension himself, as being out in the yard. But he never named Strouser. And Pepper believes that this was because he was afraid of Strouser, who, unlike Clark, was still very much alive. So in search of the truth, Bill Pepper tells the following lie.
Well, Frank, let me raise something that I've got to raise with you. First of all, I appreciate your candor. Thank you for that. And for your time. As you may know, I represented the King family here in Memphis in 1999. We sued Lloyd Jauer's for wrongful death in the King killing. It was a civil trial, 30 days and 70 witnesses. The jury came back in 59 minutes and found for the family against Jauer's. Jauer's, as you know, is dead. Maybe you didn't know.
Yeah, I know he's dead.
But it wasn't just the jury. Before he died, Jauer's admitted to myself, Andrew Young, and Dexter King. He admitted his involvement in the assassination.
He did?
Yes, he admitted it. Betty Spates had nailed him because she was at the back door in the kitchen when he brought the rifle in after the shooting.
Jauer's had the rifle?
Jauer's brought the rifle in. But before he died, hold on to yourself. He named you as the assassin.
He did that?
Yes. He named you. Why he did this, I don't know. And I found Jauer's to be a liar on a lot of things. But he did. He named you. This surprised me because for a long time I thought Clark was the shooter. Clark was a hell of a shot. And he lied about where he was that afternoon.
There was no longer a grin on Frank Strouser's face.
Earl Clark was a good friend of mine. He had strong feelings about certain things.
Was he a good shot?
Oh, yeah.
And you are a hell of a shooter, from what I understand.
I'm a dead shot. I was then. I'm certainly not now. But I don't have any idea why Jauer's would do that.
If the purpose of the lie about being named by Jauer's was to jostle Strouser into a revealing emotional response, it would appear to be a failure. Strouser doesn't get upset or angry over the accusation. He just acts perplexed. But then Pepper tells Strouser that for a good while he had thought Captain Clark was the shooter. Strouser's response is, Earl Clark was a good friend of mine. He had strong feelings about certain things. These two sentences are the most real things Strouser says the entire afternoon. He had strong feelings about certain things might be seen as Strouser's inner justification for Clark's role in the murder. And Earl Clark was a good friend of mine appears to put Strouser right next to Clark in the yard facing the Lorraine Motel. How do we come to that? According to the literature, a proper sniper team has a spotter and a shooter. The shooter has a sight on the target at all times, but the spotter takes a wider view of what's going on around the target. Each man needs to know the other well, down to how he sounds when he is breathing. And it's the spotter who is in charge, who gives the command to shoot. If Jauer's primary function is to provide the yard and take the gun and hide it, and we say for the moment that Clark is the spotter, who might we imagine the shooter to be? First, it would have to be someone who was an excellent shot. Then you would need someone who was tight with Captain Clark. And someone who shoots guns regularly with Clark, say at the police firing range.
And this is why Earl Clark was a good friend of mine, is a tell. Because Strouser was the perfect fit for Clark. Plus, according to Lenny Curtis, Strouser was the one shooting that special rifle all morning and into the afternoon on the day King was killed. Does Curtis's sworn testimony prove that Frank Strausser was out in the yard facing Lorraine that day? No, it doesn't. But it does point in that direction. So from what we've been able to piece together, it appears that Jowers, Clark, and perhaps Strausser, you've heard the evidence, you can decide for yourselves, were in the yard facing Lorraine, and one of them fired the shot that killed King. If that is true, have we solved the case? Not hardly. Because no matter how knowing and willing the men in the yard were, and how knowing and willing were those who put them there, they were all just pawns in this game. To solve this crime, we need to know who planned the murder, and who helped, looked the other way, or went along for the ride.
Next time on the MLK tapes.
He was for a McCarthy-esque right-wing vision of America.
Mr. Hunt looked over and he says, John, I've just about had a belly full of the Kennedy boys. They both need to go.
We have seen today the dark side of those activities, where many Americans who were not even suspected of crime were not only spied upon, but they were harassed, they were discredited, and at times endangered.
My aunt had been the victim of J. Edgar Hoover, you know, lying to her.
After the March on Washington, there was an acceleration. He was defined because of his speech in that demonstration in Washington as the most dangerous and effective leader in the country. And there was a paper battle between within the Bureau as to how best to attack him, and he was attacked.
So the main focus of that meeting was really trying to figure out how to take down Martin Luther King. They were quite explicit about laying out a campaign to destroy King.
Thanks for listening to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. This podcast is not specifically endorsed by the King family or the King estate. The MLK Tapes is written and hosted by Bill Klaber. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on behalf of iHeartRadio, with producers Trevor Young and Ben Kiebrick. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV, with producers Jamie Albright and Meredith Stedman. Original music by Makeup and Vanity Set. Cover art by Mr. Soul 216, with photography by Artemis Jenkins. Special thanks to Owen Rosenbaum and Grace Royer at UTA, The Nord Group, Beck Media and Marketing, Envision Business Management, and Station 16. If you have questions, you can visit our website, themlktapes.com. We posted photos and videos related to the podcast on our social media accounts. You can check them out at themlktapes. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.